Good afternoon, folks, and welcome. It's time to break free. I will be your host for the hour, David Matthew Rock, coming to you live from the constitutional carry state of Arizona via the Patriot broadcast from the trenches, 89.5 FM, Chiloquin, state of Jefferson. Simulcast on IndianaFreedomTalkRadio.com, the Grow Your Own channel, 107.5 FM, Greenville, South Carolina, Hal Apino's channel, 87.9 FM, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and many more micro broadcasts and webcasts heard around the world. Take the time to check out the number one source for Patriot news on the web at FromTheTrenchesWorldReport.com. If you'd like to contact me via email, I can be reached at DavidMatthewRock@gmail.com. This is a live call-in program. Come on up and share your thoughts and experiences. Unlike the mainstream media, listener participation is appreciated. The call-in number is 641-715-3610. Once connected, you'll be asked for the conference room number, which is 220029 in the pound sign. Hit star 6 to unmute. It is 1:02 p.m. Arizona Mountain Time. It is 100 degrees in Casa Grande, Arizona, sunny with 22% humidity. So today we're going to discuss the 1964 race riots of Rochester, New York. Joining me will be a guest who lived through the riots. We will get into it as soon as we return from these messages from our sponsors.
Dr. Bones here. Are you prepared to deal with medical issues in a disastrous situation? What would you do if medical help was not on the way? The Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook is over 400 pages of how-to advice written in plain English. You'll learn to handle all the likely medical issues you'll encounter in times of trouble. And it's not just the conventional medical wisdom. We talk about alternatives like essential oils, medicinal herbs, and other home remedies. Make the Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook a part of your survival library. And don't forget, Nurse Amy and I have medical kits, suture materials, instructional DVDs, and other items that'll help you keep it together even if things fall apart. Check them out, as well as 200 articles on medical preparedness, survival gardening, and other alternative remedies on our website at www.doomandbloom.net. Never think doom and gloom, think doom and bloom.
Divergent Flavor Labs introduces our all-original e-juice flavor line made from pure 100% kosher USP food-grade ingredients. Whether it's our flavored tobaccos like Calypso or our amazing bakery flavors like Crumbiliumptious, Divergent Flavor Labs handmade all-original flavor line will never disappoint. Available exclusively through VaporsRebellion.com.
Thank you for listening to PBFTT,
Patriot Broadcast from the Trenches, 89.5
Micro FM,
Chiloquin, the state of Jefferson.
It's time to break free, live on PBFTT, August 22nd, 2017. I'm your host, David Matthew Rock. Thank you for joining me this afternoon. Okay, so we're going to discuss the 1964 race riots of Rochester, New York, which is my home city. And joining me will be a guest who lived through the riots. Are you there, Janet?
I'm there.
Okay, everybody. This is my mom, Janet Rock. So what I wanted,
hi everyone.
What I wanted to go over first was an article out of the Democrat and Chronicle. Let's see if I can get it pulled up here. Having a few problems. Discussing the race riots, but I appear to be having a problem. So why don't you just go ahead and talk to us a little bit about Rochester and growing up in Rochester, just to give us a general feel for the city.
Well, first I'd like to talk a little bit about my mother's experience growing up in Rochester. She lived on the west side in ethnically and racially diverse neighborhood. There were Italians and Germans. I'm not too sure about Jews, but black people living there when she grew up. And she went to school with all different kinds of ethnicities, and there were black people in her school. My dad, on the other hand, he lived on the east side of Rochester in a primarily Italian neighborhood. And when I was growing up, the Italian neighborhood had changed. It had shifted, and it was diverse in the 50s and early 60s when I lived there. There were Puerto Ricans, there were Italians, mainly Italians, and black people in the neighborhood. And this is where my grandfather had his business. My grandfather and step-grandmother lived a few blocks away, and my aunts and uncles all lived nearby in houses they rented from my grandfather. And it was very much a city neighborhood. There was a parking lot next door to our house, and then my grandfather's three-story building, commercial building he owned, the meat market, was on the ground floor. Across the street was an enormous farmer's market that was held 3 days a week. And it was right near the train tracks, so lots of produce, things came in via the trains. Now, across the street from the house we lived in was a gas station. Next to that was a liquor store. Next to that was a small grocery store. Then there were some homes. Then there was a funeral home. At the end of my block, on the corner of the next block, was a very small shoe factory. Actually, they just made boots, and they were handmade boots. And a little further down from that were mostly houses. So it was very much a city neighborhood and mixed. But my parents were very much racist. My mother claims she wasn't a racist as she was growing up, that, you know, the blacks kept to themselves, the Italians kept to themselves, the Germans kept to themselves. Nobody really mixed. But she claims, you know, these were church-going people, nice families, and everybody minded their own business, and nobody, you know, there was no animosity. At the same time, I find it hard to believe that black people were not discriminated against back then. At least housing-wise, they weren't where my mother lived. But job-wise, I don't know. In the 50s, when I was growing up, my parents were very much racist. They hated black people. They did not call them black or Negroes.
I just want to stop you for a second. Wasn't there a period in time where they started bringing up people from the South and putting
them? Yeah, I'm coming to that. So in the 50s, everything you read in the newspapers, they'll tell you that Southern blacks came up here to find jobs in factories. And I'm sure that's true. I'm sure there were a lot of jobs here that white people just didn't all fill. So black people came up to fill those jobs. At the same time, in New York State in particular, that's all I can really talk about that I know, we gave welfare out to people who did not work, did not have a job. And I think a lot of people must have come up here and maybe not found jobs or maybe came up here just to receive welfare because it was being handed out. And if the father or husband, the man of the house was there, the people did not, whoever, white, black, whatever, did not get welfare. So this book, Families Apart, and I'm thoroughly convinced this was part of a socialist agenda.
I would say it's probably right in league with eugenics as well, the whole Planned Parenthood, Urban Eugenics League, Margaret Sanger, Cold Springs Harbor, if I'm getting the name correct, thing kind of going on in New York. So I imagine it all ties in. Plus, didn't New York play a part, or Rochester play a part in Tuskegee and then also the Manhattan Project? Didn't we have some involvement with that? I've kind of always had the feeling that that Rochester is kind of a test community. Like a lot of stuff that's getting tested out gets tested up in Western and upstate New York. So I'm sorry for interrupting.
Well, that's very true. That's right. That's very true. Any kind of Broadway musical, a Broadway show that they were testing came. Any kind of movie they were testing came. Any kind of new product came to Rochester. We were a very conservative city. And, yes, they were definitely test market. But, David, I don't believe that the eugenics part came in then because the more children you had, the more money you got. So there was a lot, people were having a lot of children because they got more money. Now, once Planned Parenthood came about and once, you know, abortions, well, I know Planned Parenthood was there for a long time, but once abortion became legal, that changed. But in the meantime, in the 50s and 60s, people on welfare, people in your own family on welfare had multiples of children because they kept having children. They could stay on welfare. They did not have to get out of the system. So there's that. These riots happened in 1964.
Just a second. So about what was the time period when people started moving up from work, where the population started to increase? Obviously, the welfare had something to do with it, but what time period was that, would you say again?
I'm guessing shortly after World War II when the factories all cranked up and, you know, people had no cars during the war. All that steel, hardly any new cars were being built. All that steel went to the war effort. So once people got back from Europe and Japan and Asia, wherever they were, you know, they wanted cars, and the factories geared up. So my guess is once that got going, late 40s, early 50s, mid-50s, around there, early 60s, around there.
Understood.
There were factories in the South. It was Detroit and, oh, gosh, I can't think of the name of that other big city. In Michigan, Cleveland was a big manufacturing company. We had car manufacturing in Rochester. There were little plants everywhere that made specific parts.
Yeah, like AC Delco.
Carburetors or radiators.
Okay, so let's get back to the beginnings of the riots.
Well, this is what my memory tells me, and I was 12 years old, but I believe there were riots in New York City. Solinsky went to New York City. There were riots. Solinsky made his way to upstate New York, and there were riots here. I don't know if they were here, if he was here during the riots, or they happened after he left. But looking back, okay, this organization called FIGHT, which was an acronym, was birthed with Solinsky, and I can't think of the guy's name. It's been too long. And this was an organization working for the betterment of black people. And I don't know the time frame of when he left and when the riots happened, but it was in the heat of the summer in July. I had moved from that neighborhood near my grandparents to another neighborhood in the north part of the city. I wasn't afraid that people would, you know, riot in my neighborhood because it was primarily white. and the Genesee River was just, I don't know, one street away down a hill. So we had a border there. There was a huge Catholic cemetery separating the little part of Rochester I lived in with the rest of it.
So the area was pretty well quarantined from the majority of the city, from downtown. And gotcha.
It was quarantined. Yeah, the lake was a mile and a half from where we lived. So I wasn't afraid, but at the same time, my grandmother still lived in the neighborhood, my dad's stepmother, and I had friends, you know, living on Union Street where I lived. And here's what I remember. They got their shotguns, and if they didn't have a shotgun, they went out and got them, and they sat on their porches or, you know, wherever they could see what was going on and protected their families, protected their property. What I remember on TV was a whole lot of bottle throwing and rock throwing and violence of that nature towards the police.
Now, we had fires, correct?
I do believe fires. I remember buildings, you know, looked Joseph Avenue, where the Jews primarily had their businesses, that looked like Berlin after World War II. It was decimated. And my understanding was that black people hated Jews, absolutely hated Jews. Now, I don't know how true that is. I didn't personally hear any black people, you know, disparaging Jews. That's what I had heard. I don't know. That's what people say. And that part of the city was decimated. And the rioting was out of control. There were, you know, a lot of people and not that many cops. And it went on. Now, looking back, I don't know whether agents provocateur. Did the police stand down? I don't know. I remember seeing a lot of confrontations. And I also know that police hated black people, hated them. And I know this from having talked to my grandmother's, one of her best friends' husband was a policeman. Your father had a friend. He was working security with a guy who was waiting to, on the list, he passed the test, wanted to be a cop, was just waiting for somebody to die or retire to get in there. And he had this huge flashlight, and he'd tell your father, I'm going to crack some racial slurs heads with this one. He wasn't even on the force, and he hated black people. So there was a lot of discrimination and hatred.
And let's look at it this way. It wasn't just black people. Even your father, my grandfather, was discriminated against for being Italian by the police back in the 20s and 30s.
That's very true. There was a lot of discrimination. There was for ethnic groups. The one that just arrived got discriminated by the ones that had just assimilated. And, yes, they hated, a lot of people hated the Italians. They made fun of them, called them garlic eaters, made fun of what they ate. Your great-grandmother was teased because she ate onion pie. The people where she settled around called pizza onion pie. Little did they know, there's pizzeria on every corner in every city in America now. But, you know, here's why. As far as I can tell, here is why my mother hated these Southern blacks, she called them. She felt the women did not have good morals. She felt they were promiscuous. And your grandfather, my dad, hated them because he saw his neighborhood. He saw black people go into a house, rent a house in his neighborhood, and these houses had been there. He'd seen them fine for 20, 30 years. These people would move in 6 months later. It was a ghetto.
Now, these are people, these are welfare recipients, mm-hmm. correct?
Well, I mean, I don't know exactly if they were welfare recipients, these people that came up from the South who were renting in the neighborhood, in 6 months, a house that had been standing for 25, 30 years would be, you know, the screens knocked out, the windows broken, the porch railings a mess, the stairs a mess, you know, in 6 months, just ruined. So this is why your grandfather used to complain about that.
So you're saying that there's a lot of animosity that had built up previous to the race riots, and it wasn't just blacks, it was on both sides.
I do believe, you know, yes. And they call, your grandparents call them animals. They're animals. You know, so.
So what were some of the results of the race riot? What were some of the things that happened afterwards?
Well, I just want to say one thing before that. One of the ways they got the crowds under control was with fire hoses. The police got fire hoses and shot high-pressure water at the crowds, and that's how a lot of them got dispersed. At least that's what I remember. That's what I saw in the news. Who knows what really happened? You know, this isn't the first. You know, fake news just didn't happen now. So, but here's what happened after the riots were over. I know on Joseph Avenue, where all the little Jewish shops were, they closed, and they did not go back. The Jews did not open up their stores again. They fixed them. But they didn't do business in that neighborhood again. Other places, yes, there were bakeries that had been in business for 30 years. Most of them didn't get hit. You know, some of the, in the Polish neighborhood, the Polish bakeries didn't get hit, and the German sausage shops and stuff, some of them left because they just didn't want to deal with it anymore. I mean, why would you? They just thought, I can go somewhere else and open a business, or, you know, my kid's in college. He doesn't want to be a sausage maker. I'm done with this. So a lot of the white people were making money, but, you know, this hurt the black people too. Their neighborhoods were decimated. They were a mess. And I was too young to know. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if this is in league with Saul Alinsky's rules for radicals, then it would be meant to destroy everybody, the whole of society, including the black folk. So continue.
Well, yeah, sure. It destroyed what, if there was any good feeling among whites and blacks, if there was, not likely, it certainly didn't heal any of that. It didn't change that, you know, white people hated black people more, and if they were afraid of them before, they were terrified of them after. And so that didn't help anything. People, you know, the independent business people, their businesses got destroyed. So there goes the middle class. You know, I don't know if what insurance paid or didn't pay. I would imagine the insurance companies paid for the damages, although I don't know. You know, I was too young.
Okay. Here's something I kind of wanted to bring to the table. How segregated, it's starting to change a little bit today, but even in the 90s, it was pretty still segregated in Rochester, New York. So if you think in the mindset of Hollywood and the news and all that, by the way they make you think about New York, you would think that it's completely leftist and liberal and accepting, and we're all living together and kumbaya, and it's a communist paradise. But from my experience, I saw more racism and more segregation growing up in Western New York than I ever saw in the modern South. That's just my personal experience, and I know you might be able to relate to that topic as well.
Well, yeah, there was a lot of racism, but as we went through these decades, it just went underground. People didn't use the N-word anymore. You know, I never heard people call them animals. Even your grandparents stopped saying that.
Well, let me be a little more specific. I mean segregation in communities. For example, the high school the high school I went to had 2,300 students in it, and maybe 14 of them were black. So the communities were very segregated in New York, where you would think, you know, like I said before, you would think it's a communist paradise and we're all singing Kumbaya. But, you know, we all want to point fingers at the South and talk about how bad the South is. But even here in New York, in the 90s, we're living almost completely segregated, where 1 or 2 miles makes a huge difference in the demographics.
Absolutely true. That's absolutely true. Yes. The black people started moving into the town of Gates, where a lot of Italians were, who left the city. They went to a suburb right next to where they had grown up, into Gates, and then a lot of black people moved there. But in other parts of the city, other suburbs, no. They were segregated completely, completely segregated. It's changed slowly. But black people wanted to keep to themselves, too. Now, I have a friend who, she's about my age. She's a little younger than me, in her early 60s. And she's one of six girls. She grew up in the islands. She's from Trinidad. And about 8 years ago, maybe 10 now, she was dating a white man. And three of her sisters stopped speaking to her. I was shocked. She was shocked. Their grandmother was white. They would not speak to her. So they're, you know, black people not necessarily, I found this out, might not necessarily want to mix. Not in that way anyway with white people. But yes, I agree. There was a lot of discrimination, and it wasn't some big mecca where black people could come up here and be accepted. They were hated. My family's any example of this, they were hated.
So do you think Rochester ever fully recovered from those race riots, or it's still kind of ongoing with the fabric of the city today? And do you see any parallel between what happened then and your understanding and research into the 64 race riots and the other riots in other cities that followed, maybe with what's going on today with Black Lives Matter and Antifa and this kind of managed, controlled fight that we have going on in the streets?
Well, that would, my guess would be it's just a repeat, you know, rinse, wash, and repeat. My guess is back then there were agent provocateurs, you know, Salvinsky probably salted Rochester with them or wherever he went, dropped a few off, paid, you know, and the FBI and whoever else, you know, FBI this and, you know, have a stock and whatever kind of insane Satanists were pulling this agenda back then, and I think they're doing it again now. And
well, we have an article lined up from the Democrat and Chronicle, which is the paper from Rochester, New York, that shows a little bit of the timeline, and we'll get into that as soon as we return from our bottom of the hour break.
We'll be right back.
Hey, old Dr. Bones here. Are you prepared to deal with medical issues in a disastrous situation? What would you do if medical help was not on the way? The Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook is over 400 pages of how-to advice written in plain English. You'll learn to handle all the likely medical issues you'll encounter in times of trouble. And it's not just the conventional medical wisdom. We talk about alternatives like essential oils, medicinal herbs, and other home remedies. Make the Doom and Bloom Survival Medicine Handbook a part of your survival library. And don't forget, Nurse Amy and I have medical kits, suture materials, instructional DVDs, and other items that'll help you keep it together even if things fall apart. Check them out, as well as 200 articles on medical preparedness, survival gardening, and other alternative remedies on our website at www.doomandbloom.net. Never think doom and gloom, think doom and bloom.
Divergent Flavor Labs introduces our all-original e-juice flavor line made from pure 100% kosher USP food-grade ingredients. Whether it's our flavored tobaccos like Calypso or our amazing bakery flavors like Creme de Liumptious, Divergent Flavor Labs' handmade all-original flavor line will never disappoint. Available exclusively through VaporRebellion.com.
Thank you for listening to PBFTT.
Patriot Broadcast from the Trenches, 89.5.
Micro FM.
Chiloquin,
the state of Jefferson.
It's Time to Break Free is a listener-sponsored broadcast. If you'd like to help keep this program on the air, go to FromTheTrenchesWorldReport.com and hit that donate button. Or you can mail donations to Henry Shively at Post Office Box 964, Chiloquin, Oregon 97624. Your contributions are appreciated. I'm your host, David Matthew Rock. It is 1:35 p.m. Arizona Mountain Time. And just to give myself a little bit more time, I skipped our second song coming out of the break. So do we still have Janet?
Yes.
Okay. So I wanted to touch on this article real quick. It's coming from the Democrat and Chronicle, and I believe the exact title is Riot Spawn Fight, Other Community Efforts. It should be posted at FromTheTrenchesWorldReport.com. Okay, among the 893 people who were arrested during the Rochester riots of 1964, according to the city statistics, the majority were either unemployed or unskilled workers. Those 804 people, I guess they're saying of the 893, 804 were unskilled or unemployed, gave a sense of the Rochester that was below the radar screen of the community leaders when the riots broke out. It was a great shock to people who were very confident in the benevolent nature of the community. Clearly, generous benevolence was not sufficient to deal with the problems, said Chris Lindley, who was then teaching history at the University of Rochester and later served as deputy mayor. Okay. The events of July 1964 affected the city in many ways and at many levels, spawning a host of social service agencies, including Action for a Better Community and the Urban League of Rochester, but also changed attitudes on race. Mind you, Democrat and Chronicle is a pretty liberal rag. Anyway, it made people aware of the racial divide, said Brenda King, 68, of Pittsburgh, whose father, Sam Snyderman, owned a hardware store bearing his name on Joseph, as Joseph Avenue. With the first establishment of the Fight organization in June 1965, the national spotlight focused once again on Rochester. Inspired by the biblical phrase, "Fight the good fight of faith, lay hold on eternal light." The acronym initially stood for Freedom, Integration, God, Honor, Today. The confrontational tone of Fight was reflected in Minister Franklin Florence's speech at the first Fight convention that elected him president of the group. For those who trust people, it's the dawn of the new generation of hope, Florence said. For those who fear people, it is rightly cause for fear and trembling. Kodak, like Kodak Film, at the first time began to make changes, said retired public affairs officer Charlie Fitzgibbon. But the company nevertheless became a target because it was the city's largest employer. There was significant community interest in bringing about an opportunity for change, he said, explaining that was a motivating factor for Kodak, as well as the workforce needs of a growing company. He blamed Saul Alinsky, the Chicago-based activist known for his innovative grassroots organizing for social change. Alinsky was recruited by Rochester activists to help start fight. Okay, one of the things they did was they protested in front of Kodak to make Kodak hire these groups of unskilled workers. So Alinsky and the people who exploited the situation were looking for attention, he said. But Kodak had undertaken or was developing a lot of programs that community activists sought. We are working on it. Kodak became the focus of fight protests. Florence brought groups of unemployed African Americans for job interviews, said Dorothy Hall, who worked as a receptionist in Kodak's employment office at the time and is now executive director of the Plymouth Exchange Neighborhood Association. Minister Florence was pushing for jobs, 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 Hall said, and that's in quotes. So even though we're going all the way back to 1964, we still got the same kind of rhetoric, jobs, 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 right? A Kodak assisted Vice President John Mulder reached an agreement with FITE that would have resulted in the organization sending 600 people to Kodak for possible hire, with Mulder saying it's Kodak's goal to hire them, but Kodak subsequently said the agreement was unauthorized. That led to busloads of protesters going to Kodak's annual meeting in April 1967 in Flemington, New Jersey, with signs such as Kodak snaps the shutter on Negroes. Ultimately, Kodak and FITE reached an accord in 1967 in which Louis Eliers, the new Kodak president, sent Florence a telegram recognizing FITE as a broad-based community organization and saying that the newly created Rochester Jobs Incorporated promises to be an effective way of providing jobs. Okay, so that's enough on the jobs data BS. Okay, so Democratic Chronicle. Hold on, I just got to find the timeline here. Here we go. Okay, so plans for a street dance, July 20th through 24th, 1964. July 20th, Northeast Mothers Association requests permit for a street dance to be held July 24th on Nassau Street between Joseph Avenue and Joyner Street. July 23rd, permit for street dance is issued. Two police officers assigned to maintain street and traffic control. July 24th, street dance starts with more than 200 in attendance. 11 p.m., police officers observe Randy Manigault, 21, acting in an unruly manner and bring it to the attention of the chaperone of the event. Okay, now we're moving to the next part of the timeline. July 24th, 1964, continued. Trouble starts. 11:25 p.m., the chaperone, Jesse Eugene Stevens, asks police officers to take action against Maginault. The officers arrest him on a charge of public intoxication. Maginault violently resisted arrest and was very abusive verbally. Two plainclothes officers also get involved in subduing Maginault, who continued to be abusive and complain about being beaten. By this time, the crowd starts getting involved, and some young people try to forcibly free Maginault. 11:30 p.m., police officers assist, and with the help of canine officers, Maginault is put in the police wagon and taken away. Eyewitness accounts, including one by John Ominsky, the DNC's police reporter that night, say the use of dogs is what really incited the crowd. In the early 1960s following, hold on, this continues here. Okay, well, that's a little confusing. Crowd grows. 11:40 p.m., dispatcher orders all police cars on Joseph Avenue and Nassau Street. By this time, the crowd has grown to more than 500 people and gotten violent. Stones and bottles are being thrown at police, police vehicles and civilian vehicles containing white people. Okay. Midnight, commissioner of police and chief of police notified. Okay, so it really took like about a half hour to get cooking. Tear gas fire hoses used. 12:30 a.m., police chief William Lombard arrives on the scene. Crowd out of hand and growing steadily. Official chronology starts using the word mob. 1 through 3 a.m., tear gas and fire hoses are used in unsuccessful attempts to quell crowd. Looting and vandalism reported on Joseph and Clinton Avenues, 52 arrests made. July 25th, 1964. Authorities losing control. 1:20 a.m., city manager Porter W. Homer, the chief and other officials establish an emergency headquarters and press office at the public safety building. They also issue a call for off-duty officer to report and ask Sheriff Albert W. Skinner for assistance. Police set up blockade at Central Avenue and Joseph, just outside of New York Central Railroad overpass, to keep the riot from spreading downtown. To the north of that point, crowd has the run of Joseph Avenue. Okay, so July 25th, 64, continued, emergency declared. 1:30 a.m., six people arrested for disorderly conduct in the first hour are released without bail and returned to the scene on the chief's orders in an attempt to calm the situation. First use in chronology of the word rioting. While it is included in the official account, at some point in this period, Lombard's car is overturned on Joseph Avenue near Kelly Street. City manager declares a state of emergency. City officials try to call Governor Nelson Rockefeller for authorization to call in the state police, but an aide refuses to wake up the governor. Okay, ooh, how convenient. Gotta love all that convenient stuff. Refuse to wake up the Rockefeller for the riots, right? Strengthening perimeter, 4 a.m., a small force of police and firefighters use fire hoses and other means to prevent a large fight between hundreds of white and Negro youths near the blockade at the southern end of Joseph. 5:05 a.m., city notified the governor's office is sending in state police. 5:45 a.m., about 50 additional local police arrive on the scene by bus. Despite the additional manpower and continued use of fire hoses and tear gas, officers are forced back by a barrage of rocks and bottles. Officers strengthen the perimeter to try to contain the riot. Still on July 25th, continued. City gets a breather. 7:30 a.m., first state police arrive. Police officers now number about 250, with crowd estimates at about 2,000. Police move down Joseph Avenue in close order formation, but fail to disperse the rioters. 9:30 a.m., police withdraw to perimeter around a 20-block area. Mobile and foot patrols form to make arrests for looting. DPW creates cleanup. DPW crews clean up some debris in riot areas. 11 a.m., area quiet except for scattered looting. July 25th, 64, continued. Officials announce curfew. 11 a.m., police work on plans for evening. City manager declares a curfew to take effect at 8 p.m. and continue through 7 a.m. July 26, at request of city state liquor authority, prohibits the sale of alcoholic beverages in the city and adjacent towns through 5 p.m. July 26, or until emergency is over. First discussions of calling National Guard. 6:30 p.m., 240 officers assigned to the riot area, 71 additional officers assigned to posts in 3rd Ward, Corn Hill area, East, and West Main Street, Midtown, and Atlantic University areas. July 25th continued. Violence moves to Corn Hill area. 8 p.m., sporadic acts of violence break out in the Corn Hill area. Police citywide active in arresting violators of the curfew. First reported an incident, police cars hit by a rock. Incidents breakout, 9 p.m. incidents breakout on Central Park. Property damage increases in Corn Hill and other areas on the west side. Officers moved by bus to those areas and wholesale arrests are made. First death, 10 p.m. to midnight. Sometime after 10 p.m., a man later identified as Perry Judson, Brian, 58, of Wayland, Steuben County, is killed on Clarissa Street. It is never fully explained what Brian, a white unemployed salesman with a criminal record, was doing there. Eyewitnesses' accounts say he was wearing an odd-looking helmet and trying to look to calm people down when he was hit on the back of the head with a lead pipe and then run over by a car. Meanwhile, rioters worked their way as far as Bullheads and then down Genesee Street. July 26, 1964, 500 arrests overnight. 12:15 a.m., city back under control. 12:15 a.m. to noon, control maintained by police. 500 arrests made by 6 a.m. 2:30 p.m., not an official chronology, there we go, taken from Democrat and Chronicle files, a Page Airway helicopter carrying Monroe County Director of Civil Defense Robert Abbott, 48, pilot James B. Dochardi, 45, and Robert Cannonito, another Page employee, takes off to make an aerial tour of the riot areas. Now, this is kind of interesting. This ties in right with the Charlottesville. It's amazing how history repeats itself, folks. Helicopter crash. We're still on July 26. 3:15 p.m., the helicopter starts flying erratically, according to witnesses, and crashes into a house on Clarissa Street between Tremont Circle and Bronson Avenue in Corn Hill. The pilot is killed, as are two men in the house. Abbott is severely burned and dies a month later of infection. Cannonito walks away with cuts and bruises. The Civil Aeronautics Board later rules that alcohol and pilot inexperience contributed to the crash. Well, isn't that interesting how history repeats itself? July 26, 1964, continued. National Guard arrives. 6 p.m., law enforcement officers. Numbers 550 officers, auxiliary police of the Monroe County Civil Defense assist with security fight contingent of National Guard troops, arrives in late afternoon and drives through riot areas to make presence known. In the late evening, outbreaks reported on Joseph Avenue of youths throwing Molotov cocktails at police, fire hoses used to disperse the youths. Ooh, and, okay, so my internet connection is off here, and it doesn't seem to be loading. I'll get that working in just a second. So, Janet, are you there still?
I am.
Any of that stuff kind of jog your memory? You recall any of the people that I mentioned? Any thoughts on what I just read?
I don't recall the helicopter at all. I don't remember anyone dying. Like I said, I was just a kid. All the names of that William Lombard, he was police chief for like 30 years. He never got out. It was very intense. It was very scary, and it was not under control until the National Guard came. So what lesson do we draw from this? There's a lot more of us than there are of them. That's the lesson I draw.
As in, because they were local government failed to stop the riots, or what's your point in making
that? Yeah. Well, I'm just thinking about militias and the American people in general, and us, the amount of population of us versus the military, people in the military, people in the police. So there's that. That's something to think about and contemplate. And here's the other thing. I was listening to Mark Passio this morning, and he talked about something in Philadelphia. People were gathering to protest there, and they have a police have a lot more sophisticated equipment now to deal with riots or crowds of people. In Philadelphia, they had these high-pressure water cannons, and people were actually blinded. There was one man who got hit in the eye with this water, and he was blinded by that. There were these sound cannons that were sent off during these protests in Philadelphia. I don't know when it was, 2004 or something.
No, I know what you're speaking about, and it would have been it was in 2009 in Pittsburgh, and what it was exactly about might come to my brain in a second. So continue.
The G2 conference?
G20.
Or something like that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I got it all jumbled up in my 65-year-old brain. So they had sound cannons, and people actually went deaf from those. So it's a whole new ball game now. So I don't know, just something to think about.
Well,
why aren't they putting why aren't they doing what they did back in the day? Where are the sound cannons in Charlottesville to calm everyone down, you know, to get people to disperse? That didn't happen like it did it was in Pittsburgh or Philadelphia?
Pittsburgh. I mean, if we're speaking about the same event, it would be in Pittsburgh. There's a lot of dramatic video coming out of that G20 meeting in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. So why weren't there water cannons used at the Charlottesville? You know, they used them in the white people. Why wasn't that used to control the crowd?
Because they wanted it to happen.
Obviously.
Well, here's my understanding. Anytime you get a group of people protesting something and they haven't been able to stop them or infiltrate them and shut them down, they bring in what they used to call anarchists. And they would all be young, thin-looking people. They would cover their face. And this has happened many times in many different locations. And they go around, they break stuff while the riot police sit off to the sidelines. And when they're done breaking stuff, they get out of the area of operation. And then the riot police are let loose on the protesters. And we've seen this happen time and time again. Not only have we seen this happen, we've also seen the police being caught dressing up as anarchists. So something I want you guys to consider when you're looking at all these videos, start looking at the build of some of these people. Start looking at the shoes these people are wearing or the boots. And you'll start noticing some of these people look like they might be running a mile or two every day. Some of these people look like they might be doing 200 push-ups. Some people look like they might be military agent provocateurs putting on a bandana and going breaking bank windows while the cops sit off to the side. So I think much of what we saw in Charlottesville and much of what we're going to be seeing, definitely the riots we've seen since Trump's election in California, these all seem orchestrated, you know, managed. It's not that hard to whip people up into a frenzy and get them going on one end, but at the same time, it's not that hard to shell out some bucks and put out some ads on Craigslist. We've definitely seen that going on. Any thoughts on that?
Well, it's hard to sort out what's real and what's been managed by the Satanists. That's all I can say. These people have no conscience. These people are social engineering us, and we're falling for it. I don't know why people trust the media. I don't know how much they do. But I can say a lot of my friends down here, a lot of the people I work with, a lot of my yoga students are completely naive, to all this, to the agendas. You know, they're so trusting. It just amazes me.
Well, and the real question is, are they willfully ignorant or are they truly naive? I'd be willing to bet they must be willfully ignorant, because something as simple as inflation should be waking people up. Just watching the value of your dollar decrease, meaning that it takes more dollars every decade to buy the same stuff that you bought the previous decade, that in and of itself should be waking everybody up. But I've seen refrigerator magnets joking about what things cost in the past. And I've heard many, many people throughout my lifetime just sit there and joking about, oh, well, when I was a kid, I got paid 45 cents an hour, and XYZ cost this much, and a brand new Ford Mustang cost $2,000. And my question is, well, why?
Hey, David?
Yeah, go ahead.
Here's the deal. I work at a big box hardware store, and when I talk to the men, these are men who work with their hands. Some of these men come in open carry with a pistol on their hip. These are not metrosexuals. You know, this is a small town, and a lot of them are Mexican. Some of them are white. They're big. They're brawny. They're strong, and they're aware, and they are pissed off. I'm talking these blue-collar people. I'm not talking, like, my yoga students are mostly white-collar, but a lot of people are aware. I don't know what percentage it is. I know they're mad. You know, and I guess willful ignorance, that there's a lot of that going around, but there are people who get it and who hate the police here.
Well, one thing we need to be aware of is the enemy is going to take our anger and try to use it against us. They're going to try to misdirect us. They're going to play with our emotions. They're going to try to get us to make an emotional response that they can use to demonize us. So we always have to be very careful and willing to take a step back and look at the bigger picture and to question our own thoughts and opinions on the situation, you know? We got to be careful not to go to a snap judgment because the enemy functions like a magician. You know, he's constantly doing the magician's trick. Look at my left hand while the right hand's stabbing you in the back. So you got to be looking. Go ahead.
I just said, absolutely, that's really true. That's really true. So here's my advice. Go to the blue-collar people. Don't try with the white-collar people. They have too much to lose. The blue-collar people, as far as I can tell, are mad.
And rightly so. And with that, I want to thank our guest for today, my mom, Janet Rock, and we've reached the end of the show. Come back tomorrow, folks. We'll have another one lined up for you, and enjoy the rest of your day.